This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. International Women's Day takes place in March, so this ad read is meant to celebrate women in my life who have had a lasting impact on me. Shout out to my mom, my sister, and my wife, but instead of sharing a nice story that celebrates them, I'm going to go rogue here and share some hard data with you. According to the Pew Research Center, in 2024, women earned an average of 85 cents for every dollar that men earned, and half of U.S. adults pointed to women being treated differently by employers as a major reason for that gap. So to actually celebrate women, instead of just talking about it, if you're in any sort of position of power, please start by, at the very least, paying them equally to their male colleagues. According to that same source, women, particularly working mothers, are more likely than men to say they feel a great deal of pressure to focus on responsibilities at home. Therapy can help by creating a better sense of balance and supporting your overall sense of well-being. And BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform, with its fully licensed therapists having served over 6 million people around the world. Your emotional well-being matters. Find support and feel lighter in therapy. Sign up and get 10% off at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com. This show is sponsored by Liquid IV. It's been a pretty brutal winter for a lot of the country, but even where I am in Florida, I'm looking forward to that first really warm day of the year that keeps me outside for as long as possible. The one where the sun hits your skin and you feel like you can do anything and go anywhere. But don't let the past few months of hibernation lull you into forgetting that after being outside from sunrise to sunset, our bodies need some time to catch up with their desire to be on the move. I have some travel plans coming up. Maybe some of you have spring break on the horizon. Whether it's a three-day music festival, exploring a farmer's market, or a 12-hour flight to a destination wedding, just one stick of Liquid IV mixed into 16 ounces of water offers better hydration than water alone. Right now, you can get 20% off your first order with code FILMWEEKLY at checkout. It's been a while since I went to a proper music festival, but I would have loved to have Liquid IV with me when I was there because it's incredibly easy to tear open a packet, pour it into a thermos of water, stir it up, and feel like some of your life force is being restored when those electrolytes are replenished. I just tried the sugar-free mandarin orange flavor, and it's become my new favorite. Stay hydrated with on-the-go hydration from Liquid IV. Tear, pour, live more. Go to liquidiv.com and get 20% off your first purchase with code FILMWEEKLY at checkout. That's 20% off your first purchase with code FILMWEEKLY at liquidiv.com. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Weekly. It's Wednesday, March 18th, 2026, and on today's show, we're going to be talking about the latest film and TV news. We'll chat about a horror film called Undertone and play an interview with that film's writer-director, and then I'll talk with the director of V for Vendetta. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com, and it's a pretty low-key episode of the show for you this week. I'm thinking of this as kind of a calm before the storm, because next week we're going to have a mega-sized episode talking about Project Hail Mary, Ready or Not 2, a new Netflix film, and a new-ish HBO series with interviews, I think, for all of those. So stay tuned for that. Before we get there, though, let's talk about some news, because there have been a lot of splashy announcements made over the past 7 days. Of course, the Oscars were on Sunday night. One battle after another took home Best Picture, and Paul Thomas Anderson won Best Director and Best Adapted Screenplay. The movie also won the first Best Casting Oscar in history, which is pretty cool. Sean Penn won Best Supporting Actor for his performance as Colonel Stephen J. Lockjaw, and Andy Jurgensen, who you've heard on a previous episode of the show, won the award for Best Editing. Meanwhile, the other big contender was Sinners, which won 4 awards: Best Original Screenplay for Ryan Coogler, Best Actor for Michael B. Jordan, Best Original Score for Ludwig Göransson, and Best Cinematography for Autumn Durald Argapaw, which was awesome, one of my favorite surprises of the night. And that marked the first time a woman has ever won that award, so that's pretty cool too. I was rooting for both of those movies to win big, and they did, so I don't really have many complaints in terms of the awards themselves. I was working during the broadcast, so I admittedly wasn't able to give it my full undivided attention, but I thought the broadcast itself was a little wonkier than usual. The sound mix was terrible for some reason. Some of the presenters' bits were just excruciating. Like, sorry to the Pullman family, but big yikes on that. And it sucks that the decision was made to give people time for pretty unfunny bits, like the Chris Evans, Robert Downey Jr. thing. I thought just completely fell flat on its face. But the Oscar winners for the K-pop Demon Hunters song Golden were cut off before they were able to complete their speech. So that was a huge bummer there. But anyway, shout out to Javier Bardem. And you can read more about many of the winners at slashfilm.com. There's been a lot of casting news recently. Kate Winslet is supposedly going to be playing the female lead in Andy Serkis's The Lord of the Rings, The Hunt for Gollum. We don't know for sure who she's going to be playing yet, but we have an article speculating about that on the site. And as usual, I will link to that in the show notes so you can find it easily there. Tommy Lee Jones and Betty Gilpin have joined Ethan Hawke in season 2 of the FX series The Lowdown, which was one of my favorite shows of last year. So this is really cool news. The last time Tommy Lee Jones was in a TV series was Lonesome Dove in the 1980s. So he must have really responded to the character or maybe the scripts that he's seen so far. I'm very excited about the return of this show. And if you still need to catch up with it, you can check it out on Hulu. It's called The Lowdown. John Krasinski shared a photo of some scripts for A Quiet Place Part 3, which he's returning to direct, and he revealed that not only are Emily Blunt and Cillian Murphy coming back to reprise their roles from earlier in the franchise, but Jack O'Connell from Sinners and 28 Years Later, The Bone Temple, Jason Clarke from Dawn of the Planet of the Apes and Zero Dark Thirty and a bunch of other stuff, and Katie O'Brien from Love Lies Bleeding and Mission Impossible The Final Reckoning are also on board to star as well. So we'll see if he's able to deliver something that was as good as A Quiet Place Day One, which I think surprised a lot of people, myself included. Billie Eilish, who is co-directing a concert film with James Cameron that's going to be coming out sometime in the next few months, is going to be making her proper acting debut in a new adaptation of Sylvia Plath's The Bell Jar, a great book that I know means a lot to a whole lot of people. Sarah Polley, who directed Women Talking and popped up on The Studio in season 1, is attached to direct that movie, which feels like a really, really good fit for that material. So I'm excited about that. Patrick Wilson has joined the cast of The Last of Us season 3, which might be its final season. He'll be playing the father of Abby, the character played by Caitlin Dever. And he'll be seen entirely in flashbacks or maybe as some kind of ghostly figure or something, because that character was murdered by Pedro Pascal's Joel at the very end of season 1. Abby's father is the surgeon who is going to operate on Ellie and synthesize a cure for the virus that's been sweeping the world in that show. But Joel went on that rampage through the hospital to save Ellie's life, and that decision obviously has had some major consequences for everybody involved. I feel like the general reaction to season 2 of The Last of Us was not as strong as season 1, and I feel like a lot of people just kind of shrugged it off, but I really loved both seasons, and I think it's a tremendous adaptation of a great two-game series. I think The Last of Us season 3 is supposed to come out sometime in 2027, so I am eagerly anticipating that. The White Lotus season 4, speaking of HBO stuff, has added a bunch of names to its cast, including Kumail Nanjiani, Max Greenfield, Chloe Bennett, Charlie Hall, and Gerard Paul, who are joining Helena Bonham Carter, Steve Coogan, Sandra Bernhard, Vincent Cassell, Ari Grainer, Chris Messina, Alexander Ludwig, a bunch of other people. In non-casting news, the planned reboot of Buffy the Vampire Slayer is currently dead at Hulu. Chloe Zhao shot the pilot for a continuation of that show, with Sarah Michelle Gellar coming back and co-starring alongside a younger Slayer. But according to some reports, a Hulu executive decided to pass on the project after a bunch of back and forth. There's evidently a lot of drama about that that you can read about elsewhere if you're interested, but the fandom has a lot of things to say there. Speaking of projects that once originated with Joss Whedon and have passionate fandoms, Firefly is apparently being resurrected as an animated series, with the surviving original cast members all coming back to reprise their roles. The show is still in early development, but if it moves forward, it's going to be set between the events of the ending of the original series, which famously only lasted one season, and the movie Serenity, which came out in 2005 and picked up a little while after the events at the end of the show. I loved the show back in the day, and I thought the movie was really great at the time. I have not revisited either in a very long time, and I can't imagine that the show in particular holds up super well these days, but I know there is a massive, massive fan base out there that is still very devoted to this, so they'll certainly be excited about this news. Mark Guggenheim and Tara Butters are working on this as showrunners, and Joss Whedon is not involved. I mentioned last week, I think, that Paramount hired Max Landis to write a G.I. Joe movie, and now the studio has passed on the treatment that Landis wrote for quote-unquote creative reasons. Good riddance, as far as I'm concerned. Danny McBride, who I mentioned previously, is apparently still in talks and kind of in the mix there, so we'll continue to track that story as it develops. And finally, I just saw this morning that Michaela Cole, who wrote and starred in I May Destroy You for HBO, is now writing and directing a remake of Bloodsport, the Jean-Claude Van Damme action movie, for A24. She said, "I've long been in awe of fighters and astounded by the discipline, intensity, and isolation the sport demands of them. I'm excited to explore this world, especially so with A24 as my collaborators. Let's fucking go." So that was her statement. Talk about an unexpected pairing of creative with material. I mean, this is like way, way out of left field from what I've expected from Michaela Cole. So I'm excited because it sounds like this could be a big swing and certainly a creative diversion from the type of stuff that I think a lot of people expect from this particular filmmaker and creator. So, yeah, bring it on. Let's go. I'd love to see what a Bloodsport movie written and directed by Michaela Cole looks like. So, yeah, a lot of news. Let's take a quick break and we'll be right back. I'm joined now by Slash Film editor and chief film critic Chris Evangelista.
Hello.
All right, Chris, let's talk about Undertone. This is the new movie from, I believe, first-time feature filmmaker Ian Toussaint. And this is basically a movie about a scary podcast or, you know, a horror podcast where something goes awry. I guess without getting into like full spoilery details quite yet, what do you think about this film?
I really like this. You know, I don't really get scared by horror movies, and I don't say that to be like, look at how brave I am. It's just that I've you know, horror is pretty much my favorite genre, so I've sort of like become desensitized to actual scary stuff in movies. Like I watch horror movies and I really appreciate them, but they very rarely like creep me out, and this actually got to me. And so whenever that happens, I'm doubly impressed, because it's rare to get that sort of reaction from me, and this really did a good job of like getting under my skin and giving me the creeps. And like, I don't think it's a terribly original movie. I feel like a lot of the stuff that's going on here has been done in many other horror movies, but it's just done in a really effective way, and I appreciate that. So I really had a good time with this.
Yeah, we see two actors on screen in the entire movie, and there's another person who is one of the two leads of the film, who is a disembodied voice. It's the podcast's co-host who lives in another city. So it's an incredibly small cast. It's, I mean, outside of Buried with Ryan Reynolds, I can hardly think of a movie with a smaller cast than this. But I thought the creativity of what they were able to do with just very, very limited resources. And it's basically a one location film as well. It all takes place in this one house. I thought it was pretty impressive. What did you think about it on a technical level?
Yeah, I'm actually in the middle of writing my review for this, but I touched on this in my review that I read that the filmmaker actually shot this in his parents' actual house, which I think really goes a long way towards adding to the film, because like, it doesn't feel like a set. It feels like the type of like outdated house your elderly parents live in. Like, it's got like shag carpeting on the steps and stuff like that, and there's also like religious iconography all over the place. And I feel like if you grew up in a sort of like Catholic or Christian household, you know that like when it gets dark at night, that stuff like just feels weird and creepy. Like when I was growing up, my mom had this like painting of Jesus above our like entryway door. And I remember when I was a kid, like at night, that thing would just like creep me out, like Jesus and his like creepy eyes like following you around. And I feel like you get a lot of mileage out of that stuff. Like, I feel like it's pretty obvious that this filmmaker grew up surrounded by like that sort of iconography, because that's the only way you can understand how like unnerving that stuff is, if you like see it at night in your parents' old house. And I feel like, so like I also was really impressed with the camera work here, where a lot of the shots are deliberately shot in this way where the main actor, whose name is Nina Curie, her name is Evie, a lot of times she's shot like sort of like off to the side, and she's not like dead center of the frame, and there's a lot of like open negative space behind her. Mm-hmm. And that goes a long way towards building this like sense of dread, because, you know, watching movies has conditioned us to sort of like expect something to fill that negative space. So like, I don't know about you, but like, I was constantly like, my eyes were constantly like darting to those like dark open spaces being like, is something going to like pop up in there? And like, more often than not, nothing actually shows up in that frame, but you're so like expecting it that you like, it builds that dread in you where you're just like, oh man, something's going to like show up in that dark little corner of the room. And so I really liked how they did that. The sound design is fantastic. It's impeccable. I saw this in a Dolby theater, which only like enhanced the experience. Like there were like multiple moments where like my chair was literally like rumbling from like stuff rumbling on the soundtrack and stuff like that. So yeah, just a really effective, creepy movie. I really had a good time with this.
Yeah, the framing you're talking about where there's so much negative space there, I was doing the exact same thing, just like desperately scanning the image looking for something. And there are a couple moments where you actually see some things. I mean, not to spoil too much. Yeah. So it's it makes it all the more effective just like having a couple little moments, because then you're kind of on edge the whole movie looking and trying to get ahead of what the movie's going to do almost. The idea that this character is going to podcast in the middle of their dining room is one of the worst podcast setups I've ever seen. Like, you're completely surrounded by basically open space. And like, there's, you know, just from an audio perspective, that's a terrible choice to do that. But also, it's kind of a perfect horror movie setup because it's like 360 degrees of places that creepy things could happen around this character. So I understand why they made that choice, but it was just very funny to me. Like, some of the technical stuff, like, you know, as somebody who has worked on a podcast, my first podcast was in 2010, Chris. So I've been doing this for a long time. And it's just very funny to watch anybody in any kind of media. You know, if you watch Only Murders in the Building, for example, those characters create a podcast. And the way that they do it is just so unlike my experience of what it's actually like to put a podcast together. And that definitely applies here, where like these characters, I was just thinking about what the editing process would be like and the producing process would be like, of like, we hear the raw conversation that Evie and her co-host are having. And I'm like, man, this sounds like an absolute nightmare to cut an episode together from this conversation. But it works really well in a horror context.
I was having that same thought. Like, Hollywood has not figured out how to portray podcasts on screen yet. I don't know if you watch it, but like, Netflix has a show called Nobody Wants This. It's like a comedy show with Kristen Bell on it. And her character is a podcaster on that show, and she podcasts with her sister. And they show them recording the podcast by like sitting on their couch holding microphones in their hands. I was like, no one podcasts like this. Like, what is this? And like, back to your point, like in this movie, like the way the movie unfolds is they're like, let's just listen to raw audio files live. And at one point they get like people calling into the podcast. And it's like, this is not how podcasts like, they seem to think podcasts are the same thing as like radio. And it's a completely different like setup. And I don't think people were like, I get why it's like easier to portray it this way. But I do feel like if you've done any sort of podcasting in your life, it's going to immediately like be like, that's wrong. They shouldn't be doing it like that.
Yeah, at one point they're like, we're taking calls. And it's like, this isn't a live episode. You guys haven't edited this together yet. Like, what is going on here? So anyway, that stuff was like pretty amusing. But what did you think about the actual audio in those files that the characters are listening to? Because that's basically the premise of the movie, is that these two characters host this horror podcast and they get sent, I think anonymously, or somebody from like a bizarre email address or something, sends them 10 files. And the structure of the movie is these two podcast hosts going through all of these files and listening to it and just being like increasingly creeped out by that. But what did you think about the actual content of those files? And you alluded to the sound design being good in terms of like the design of the Dolby and stuff, like hearing stuff over certain shoulders and like actually the way that they physically made the sound translate into the theatrical experience. But what did you think about the files themselves and kind of like how that impacted the plot?
Yeah, I like the way they're handled. There's a lot of like silence in between like things, and like I appreciate that, like how it builds on it. I do think I was saying earlier how the movie isn't terribly original, and I feel like a lot of what they're listening to, Without getting into too many spoilers, it's like they're listening to a married couple record themselves sleeping. It's very clearly Paranormal Activity influenced, which is kind of crazy because Ian Tosin, the director, has just been announced as the new director of Paranormal Activity. So it's almost like this movie is like him auditioning for that. Yeah. Because it's very like that whole scenario, like couple records themselves sleeping and creepy stuff happens. Like that's literally what happens in Paranormal Activity. It's just that instead of like video recording, it's audio recording.
Yeah, I thought about the paranormal connection as well in terms of the camera work too, because I think it's Paranormal Activity 3. They put the camera on like an oscillating fan and it's going left and right across the room and panning in that way that the camera work is very similar to that in Undertone as well. But I thought that stuff, the sound files worked really, really well. And it kind of it strikes me as a really, really smart thing to do as a low budget filmmaker, because you're crafting a whole world that the audience is able to insert themselves into that you don't have to show. You don't have to spend any resources to actually physicalize that. You can just create this kind of scary situation that these people experience that we, the audience, are kind of like dropped into. So I thought that stuff worked really well.
Yeah.
Is there anything else about this movie that we should talk about? I guess I do want to talk about the very, very end of the film for a second. So if you've not seen Undertone yet, press pause, go check it out, come back. I'm going to have an interview with the director coming up pretty soon, so check that out. So the very end of the movie, Chris, I was pretty on board with this film throughout most of it. I mean, my quibbles with the reality of the podcasting aside. And then the film builds to this climax, and it kind of builds to such a frenzy that I disconnected from the movie. And I don't know if you had that experience or if it was just me, but it kind of felt like when the movie was in kind of a lower key, I thought it was much more effective than when it got into this like heightened, oh my God, everything is coming together all at once moment.
Yeah. I didn't disconnect, but I do know what you're saying. There's like multiple moments as the movie's drawing to a conclusion where I was like, oh, this is where they're going to like, so basically like, If you watch as many movies as we do, you sort of like can figure out how these things are going to go. And I knew that this type of movie was going to end in a certain way where it's like, oh, they're going to cut to black and imply something bad happened to the main character. Like there's no other way to end a movie like this. Like that's just literally how all the cards are being laid out on the table. So it's like, all right. So there are multiple moments as the movie's drawing to an end. I was like, all right, this is that cut to black moment. But then it keeps going. I was like, all right, this is that cut to black moment. And then it keeps going. I was like, oh man, they're overdoing it just a little bit. At the same time, I appreciate, again, like the sound design is so like good and creepy that it creates this sort of like panic attack feeling. We're just like, oh man, everything is going incredibly wrong here. I do feel like the filmmaker, probably felt like he had to show more than he actually really needed to, because I'm sure someone out there, this is the type of movie that like people who are casual horror fans will watch this and be like, nothing happened, even though a lot happens in the movie. But I feel like he was trying to like head that off in the past and be like, all right, I got to throw some stuff in here so no one complains. Right. But I, as a guy who, you know, loves horror and appreciates like more subtle dread, I don't need that. So like I get why it's there, but I feel like the movie would be even better without that stuff.
Yeah, right there with you for sure. All right, well, now that we're in spoiler territory, anything specific you wanted to mention? The only thing that came to mind for me that we haven't talked about yet is just the sound and the idea of like a sort of disturbed mother putting her baby in like a pillowcase or a bag and like slamming it against pipes is like so disturbing to me, and just really well done from a sound perspective. But anything else about the movie stand out to you?
Yeah, I gotta say, I'm really kind of surprised they went there with that moment where, cause like they imply it earlier cause they get the call from someone who says like someone living in our basement did that. So I figured that's what they were building to, but I really didn't expect them to like flat out, like give us like a sound of a baby being smashed to death. And it's like, That's a lot to put that in your movie. So I was really kind of, I don't want to say impressed. That's like the wrong word. Like, I'm impressed they smashed that baby. But but it's pretty ballsy stuff to like go that far with your thing. I do feel like there's some things I'm just like not entirely clear on what they're going for. Like at one point, while everything is falling apart at the end, like the image from that cursed YouTube video they were talking about shows up on the TV, and I was kind of like thrown off by that because I'm like, oh, okay, are they implying that that cursed YouTube video is what's actually causing all this? Because they shrugged that off as being fake, but why are they showing it? Right, so like I'm not entirely sure why they threw that in there, if like I'm reading the moment wrong or what, but I found that like sort of like a little be like, oh, that's confusing. Like, why is that there? Like, I don't know.
Yeah. I think that's part of my disconnect was like, there was just too much going on. And I felt like, okay, I feel like I've lost the logic of the movie a little bit. And so I can't track exactly what I'm supposed to be following. And it was really easy and very clear to track what was happening before and very like effective and well done. And then all of a sudden when that frenzy begins, it's just kind of like, I just kind of like threw up my hands a little bit. And that's not exactly the way you want a movie like this to end, or the feeling you want to have walking out of a movie like this. But I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, because I think overall the effectiveness of the movie was so strong that I'm still going to think fondly about this when I think back on it, you know, years from now, just because of how well done everything was. But I do think they really kind of fumbled it right at the 1 yard line, or whatever you want to say.
And I got to say, like, my only other real complaint, and it's not even really a real complaint, but like, even though obviously this stuff turns out to actually be paranormal and haunted and cursed, whatever you want to call it, the fact that Justin is his name, the co-host, is so willing to like believe everything really got on my nerves after a while. Yeah. Like there's a part where like someone calls it, like anytime like he hears any sort of story, he's like, oh my God, I can't believe that happened. And it's like, I get that like you need one of them to be skeptical and one of them to be the true believer, but he's a little too quick to be like, I 100% believe this happened. Like, all right, Justin, dial it down just a little bit.
Yeah, he's like, you don't believe that that's real? And then she's just like, calm down, man. Like, what are you saying? So, I enjoyed their dynamic to a degree, but both of them were like a little heightened in a way that it kind of made me roll my eyes a little bit. But overall, I still enjoyed the experience. And
this is great. Like, if you're like a horror fan who's sort of like desensitized to horror like I am, I really recommend this, because I do think it's got a way of getting under your skin. And like, as I was leaving the theater, I had that sort of like creeped out vibe. I was like walking in my car and I was like, I'm legitimately creeped out here. And I'm always impressed when that can happen, because like I said, I'm so like burned out on horror that like very, very rarely does it get to me. And so hats off to you, Undertone.
Excellent. All right. Thanks, Chris. Let's go now to my conversation with the director. I was so impressed by the creativity of what you were able to do with one house and only two actors physically on screen in this movie. Can you tell me about your approach to making the most of a limited number of resources and working with your team to pull this off?
Well, I discovered that with little resources, you're forced to be creative. There's a lot of problems that need solutions, and I need to dig for those solutions. Every shot has an intention, and if the intention is to move through a space bigger than what we're shooting in, then I really have to dig into my memory and think of a film that did it the same, like did it similarly. Yeah. And that's pretty much what I was doing in the writing process. I was watching a lot of other films, and I was taking aspects of that film and then using it. So The Babadook is a good example. When you transition into a scary scene from night to day, you start with showing empty wides of the house, around mm-hmm. the house.
Yeah.
And that establishes the space you're in. But more than that, it establishes that there's a lot of spaces that Evie can't see.
Yeah. And yeah, so absolutely.
There's a lot of cutting to different areas of the house, and that was one technique to solve that particular problem. And then I just kept on doing that for every scene, using a different movie to reference for every scene.
Well, obviously the sound in this film is incredible and hugely important to what you're going for here. And I really think the movie accomplishes this magic trick of playing audio and making the audience feel like we're there in another scene that we're not actually watching. Did it take some trial and error to figure out how long you could hold on those audio files that Evie and Justin listen to before that spell starts to wear off for the audience a little bit?
Yeah, it was a lot of trial and error, but it was mostly in my head, because I could picture everything, and so I'm almost like Evie listening to these audio files I imagined up, and as a director, I'm thinking of what am I gonna show, and I mentioned other films they use certain techniques. But I also made a list of camera angles, rear shots, three-quarter shots, side profiles. Is the negative space in the background in front of Evie or behind Evie? Where is the negative space in relation to Evie? Is the entire shot negative space? And I would just, and then movement, so panning. Pushing. I had a list, and I even remember having a Word doc with each shot, and then copy and pasting those shots into the script whenever I felt like I needed it. So the shooting script was a lot of camera direction, a lot of sound direction, more sound direction than camera direction. And the storyboards were pasted directly onto the original script, which was about 270 pages long.
Wow.
Yeah. And the movie was right there in the document. So it was a Word doc, which frustrated the producers because they wanted me to work on Final Draft, which I didn't want to do. But now I've gotten used to it, so now I'm working in Final Draft.
That's good. So tell me about creating the audio for those files. Were you there when those were recorded? Do you let your sound team handle that, and then you tweaked things afterwards? How did that work?
Yeah, we recorded them a couple of days before principal photography here in the house. We recorded them organically, so we had Mike and Jessa, which is Jeff Young and Kiana Bastidas. We had them lie in bed in Mama's bedroom. We had them hold an iPhone that was recording the audio as Mike was walking around the house, sometimes running. And we captured a lot of it organically. And then on set, when Nina was in, we had her... we had her listen to the recordings for the first time when we're shooting those scenes.
Oh, that's cool.
So her reactions were genuine.
That's really cool. Yeah, I was just talking with a colleague of mine about this movie and how we both thought that maybe there was some Paranormal Activity influence in there. And then I read that you're now working on the next Paranormal Activity film, which is pretty cool. So can you just talk a little about the experience of maybe being partially inspired by something like that for this movie and then now having the chance to actually work on that same franchise?
Yeah, the found audio tapes or the emailed audio recordings were inspired by the found footage video in Paranormal Activity, complete with a young couple and weird sounds happening around the house at night. And then, you know, I added the other world, which is the world of the house, and then overlap now with the world of the audio tapes. So with Paranormal Activity, I had to study it a lot. I loved the first three, and I had to really figure out what made them scary so that I could make these audio tapes sound scary. So I did the homework. So when they asked if I would do Paranormal Activity, it was really easy. It was already done. They asked me to pitch them an idea. I pitched it to them. Then they asked me to write a 3-page outline. I gave them a 28-page script, 28-page treatment. And based on that treatment, they offered me the job. And I just thought it was all lined up leading to that.
Yeah, that's really cool. So I know I don't have much more time with you, but I know that A24 eventually acquired distribution rights to this, but that was well after the movie was finished. So when you were setting out originally to get financing for this, how did you go about doing that as a first-time feature filmmaker?
Well, I had resources that I could have used without anyone's help.
Okay.
I had my house. So this is my house. I had a small inheritance, and I was about to make it myself, but some producers heard that I was doing that, and then read the script, and then asked if they could be involved, and they put more money into it, and then we. You know, there's, you know, one thing I learned is that if you're willing to bet on yourself, then other people are more willing to bet on top of you. And then I found that only until they found out and knew that I was going to do it anyway, regardless of their help, I think that created some FOMO. In these producers. So, and then they just, one after the other, they just, the money just kept coming until we had an ideal budget for something as small as this.
Yeah, that's great. So when you showed them the script, were you showing them the Word document that you had, or was it, did it ever get converted into final draft?
Yeah, I was showing them the Word document, and then eventually we had to. Cody Callahan, he spent a day, or maybe 2 days, converting it to final draft so that they could now proceed with casting. We don't want to show cast this Word doc with all this nonsense on it, like. Sound direction and camera direction.
Yeah.
Photos of Sopranos.
Well, I think it paid off wonderfully. So congratulations on the movie. And I thought it was really, really effective. And I'm looking forward to seeing what you do next.
Thank you so much.
Take care. Okay. When was the last time you watched V for Vendetta? I enjoyed that movie when it came out, but in 2006, I was not even close to as politically aware as I am now. The movie, which came out 20 years ago, depicts a government in which marginalized people are unfairly demonized, secret police are assaulting and killing citizens in the street, and a blustering authoritarian figure desperately tries to control the media. So, just putting that out there. Natalie Portman is fantastic in this film, and Hugo Weaving stepped in to play the role of V, a morally murky character who has personal scores to settle, while also advocating for the idea that people shouldn't be afraid of their governments, governments should be afraid of their people. If it's been a while since you've watched this, I would recommend giving it another look. It's currently streaming on HBO Max, and I had a lot of fun revisiting this. To celebrate the film's 20th anniversary, I caught up with James McTeague, who had worked closely with the Wachowskis before this, and continued that collaboration on this project. Lana and Lily wrote the script, and McTeague made his feature directorial debut with this film. So here is my conversation with James McTeague. Hey, James, how are you?
Hey, Ben, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for taking the time today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, yeah. Pleasure.
So I'd like to start with something I'm sure you've heard a lot, but given everything happening in the world right now, did you ever imagine that 20 years after this movie came out, it would be more relevant than ever?
I have no idea what you're talking about, Ben. no, right? Like, I think that you can only, you can look to history, right? And you can look to the present and you can imagine the future, right? Like a lot of science fiction does. But I felt like we go through cycles, these, you know, same political cycles. And so I guess I wasn't surprised that we'd end up back, you know, in this kind of cycle that we're in at the moment, right? In the same way that, you know, the Nazi Germany went through that cycle, or, you know, with Mussolini, the Italians went through that cycle, or, you know, Alan Moore and David Lloyd went through that cycle with the Thatcherite government, right? And at the time we were looking around, it was the Bush administration at the time. And I think that we always, you know, as a society, we like default to these political cycles, I guess, and then we recorrect, right? So I think we'll obviously at some point have a recorrection of where we're at the moment. But then in 20 years' time, or 15, or however long the next cycle takes, we'll end up in a not dissimilar way. And I think you always have these also these political figures who are outlandish, right? In the way that Hitler was an outlandish political figure, Mussolini was an outlandish political figure, Thatcher in her like big beehivey kind of, you know, extreme way was a, you know, one of those political figures, and we're sort of here now at the moment.
Yeah. From your perspective, what's it been like to see the V mask adopted by activist groups all over the world?
Amazing, actually, right? Because, you know, that means it's totally slipped into the culture, which is the most amazing thing to happen to your film, right? And I think that it leads to the idea that people really understand the movie and what the mask can do. And that, you know, that understanding is that I can protest without being arrested or vilified. And there's more power in we than there is I, right? And mm-hmm. I think that that's a really good reading of the film. That's kind of why the film's a little, you know, why it's timeless in a way, right? Because people got the movie, right? Like sometimes you release a movie and people have no idea what you're reaching for. But I think people really understand what V for Vendetta is.
Yeah, it's interesting because even 20 years later, there aren't that many studio films that have that kind of messaging in it and like this kind of iconography of government buildings being blown up and things like that. I mean, you can probably count on one hand the number of studio released movies that that deal with that kind of stuff. Do you remember experiencing any sort of pushback or fear from the studio level for some of the subject matter you were going for here?
No, and surprisingly so, to tell you the truth, right? But we were all, you know, me and the Wachowskis and Grant Hill, the producer, right? We were all coming off the back of the Matrix movies that had made a gazillion dollars for the studio, right? So that was first and foremost. You guys want to make another movie? Go make another movie. Well, it's got some politics in it. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about that, right?
Wow.
And so, no, not really. The script was, the adaptation that the Wachowskis did was great, right? It was, you couldn't not pick up that script and just go, okay, this will be a good movie, right? you've got to get the casting right, got to film it right. But the script was a great script, and I think they could see that. I felt like Joel Silver, the famous Joel Silver, he shepherded the movie through the studio in a way that made sense. And then, no, really, I only had one kind of meeting with the studio about it, and that was, can you take the Valerie sequence out of the movie? And I'm like, that's the lesbian relationship that the movie star has,
Yeah,
right?
I'm just trying to think of what the film would even look like without that in it. It seems like totally counterintuitive.
You can't take that out, right? It's the thing that transforms Evie, right? It's like all that whole story that she gets on the rolls of toilet paper through the hole in the wall, right? It's the crucible of the movie, right?
Yeah.
And so I said no, and they went okay, and that was kind of it. And so, kudos to them, right? And then they really got behind releasing it too, right? They like. Yeah, we went a lot of places on that press junket.
Yeah. You mentioned casting, and my understanding is that James Purefoy shot for 6 weeks as V before dropping out of the movie and being replaced by Hugo Weaving. Do you remember what the disagreement was about how that character should be played?
It wasn't 6 weeks, by the
Okay.
way. Oh, yeah, it was. I got to the end of the second week, and I think we could see that he was having trouble being beneath the mask, right? It made him sort of uncomfortable and act, because James is a good actor, James Purefoy is a good actor. But it was the mask itself that was making him a little uncomfortable, right? And that was affecting his performance. And so we parted ways. And then when I spoke to Hugo Weaving about it, he's like, yeah, I'll do it. I want to do a film behind a mask, right? Like that. And he really came in and embraced it. And he'd done mask work beforehand, right, when he was back at drama school. And so he came in and he got the physicality right. He got the voice right. It was just a different performance.
Yeah,
Yeah.
yeah.
But
He
yeah, like, we didn't have some massive disagreement. We just said, hey, this isn't working.
Gotcha. Yeah, Hugo and Natalie are so incredible in this. I revisited the movie before our conversation today, and one of the things that stuck out to me that I really appreciated this time around is I realized how much of a detective film it is. Like the iconography of the costume and the explosions and the citizenry rising up to demonstrate and all of that has really lingered for people, I think. But the bulk of the actual story is uncovering a mystery. So, what do you remember about that aspect of making the movie?
Well, I liked it. For me, it's a political thriller, right? And it has a very heavy, like, gumshoe aspect to it, which is like the whole Finch story, right? And Finch's idea that he has to capture this guy, but he understands what this guy is doing, right? He's the most bemused part of the cabinet that Sutler runs, right? But yeah, I know people. So the film balances the personal with the spectacle, right? But a lot of the movie is just people talking, right?
Yeah.
Like, and that's and there's a lot of Finch talking. There's a lot of Evie talking, right? There's all those scenes with Sutler and the cabinet and Dietrich and all his stuff. So it's a bit of a Trojan horse like that, actually.
I mean, even with all of those scenes where there are just people talking, I'd forgotten that this was your feature directorial debut, which is really astounding. And I mean, I know you'd done a bunch of second unit directing before this, but this is still like a major production for a first-time filmmaker. So did it feel overwhelming, like stepping into such a big movie for your first thing out of the gate?
It didn't, right? Really, because I'd been a first assistant director on really big movies, right? Like on all those Matrix movies, on Star Wars, Moulin Rouge, like, a bunch of things that were big filmmaking undertakings. Like those second and third Matrix movies were like 200 plus back then, with a lot of moving parts and a lot of actors. And so when I stepped into it, it was a different part of my brain that, I started to use. I remember at the end of the first week of shooting, I was like exhausted. I'm like, oh my God, this is like But it felt like I flowed into it a bit. You know, like I was saying before, the script was great. And so that helped. A lot of the people I had around me, I knew, like Owen Patterson, the production designer, the Wachowskis were the producers, Grant Hill was a producer. So, you know, there was a lot of uplifting that those guys did. So yeah, but yeah, it was a decent sized movie. Yes, it was.
When you think back to being on set, do you have a favorite memory from the production?
Oh, that's a good question. I really liked working with Hugo and Natalie. You know, the first scene that Hugo shot is when Evie or Natalie comes out of the Potemkin prison, right? And I was really worried. You know, I'm like, okay, if this doesn't work, what do I do, right? Like, I'm onto my, you know, directorial debut, and I've had to, you know, get rid of the lead actor. But then Hugo came out and did this like amazing, you know, performance. So I felt really happy about that. I really liked the underground tube station knife fight sequence. You know, and that's a kudos to Chad and Dave and the Wachowskis. You know, and Creedy's death. I really love shooting all that. Yeah, there were lots of really, you know, great moments. I love them moment when Evie goes out onto the rooftop, right? You know, God is in the rain and all that stuff, right? Yeah, I really love making that movie though. I have lots of great memories of that movie.
That's excellent. Is there an aspect of the film that you feel like maybe doesn't get talked about enough or is maybe overlooked that you'd like to shine a spotlight on?
Look, you know, I mean, I think it's interesting to have, like you were saying, like a major motion, you know, studio that makes ultimately a film about the morality of terrorism, right? I really think that's like a brave thing that the movie did, right? And, you know, I'm not. I'm just saying it's a good discussion to have, right? Because it's ongoing and never goes away. And I think as a society, we never really ask the question about what causes that? Like, why, you know, like, what is the root cause of that? And I think that's an important discussion to have. And it's ongoing. I think that's why people relate to V, because they, even though he's this horrendous murderer with this crazy vendetta, right? At some point, he's very human, and people key into why he's human and key into how he was wronged. They don't agree particularly with the way he's going about, you know, wronging his, you know, his righteous path. But they're like, oh, that's interesting. It's an interesting thing to have a discussion about.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I think I'm out of time with you, but thanks so much for the conversation today, and thanks for making the movie. And it does feel like a timeless thing, I guess, unfortunately, in some ways, but it
I'd
holds
have
up
to
really,
agree with
really
that,
well.
Ben.
All right, well, take care. Have a good one.
Okay, you too, man.
All right, that'll do it for this episode of the show. You can find more about some of the stories we mentioned on today's show at slashfilm.com and linked in the show notes for this episode. You can subscribe to Slash Film Weekly on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Check out patreon.com/popculture to hear more from many of the folks you heard on this episode. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really helps us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. We'd really appreciate that. Thank you so much for listening, everyone, and we'll talk to you next week.